WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Samuel Goldwyn was one of the moguls that made Hollywood the movie capital of the world. The movies he produced include Wuthering Heights, Stella Dallas, The Best Years of Our Lives, The Little Foxes, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and Guys and Dolls. Goldwyn died in his mid-90s in 1974. A. Scott Berg has written a new biography of Goldwyn. Berg is also the author of a biography of Maxwell Perkins, the celebrated literary editor who worked with F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, and Thomas Wolfe. I asked Berg to give us a sense of Goldwyn's place in the movie world.
I think Samuel Goldwyn was the most important independent producer in the history of Hollywood, and it was he who helped start MGM, United Artists, Paramount Studios, and most important, created the whole mold of the creative independent producer that's really running Hollywood today.
When Samuel Goldwyn Jr. Asked you to write the biography of his father, you were, I think, a 30-year-old writer who had already written an acclaimed biography of a great literary editor. Now, that doesn't seem like the first credit that someone would look for a person to write the biography of a film mogul. Why did Goldwyn Jr. choose you? Do you know?
Well, I think I have some ideas, and I think it was to his credit in a way. I mean, not to have picked me specifically, but generically, which is to say, I think he knew his father was a man of great importance culturally, amusingly enough, to the United States and the world because of his place in film. But beyond that, he also knew that he had 60 years of archives, which he locked up the day his father died. And I think he knew that those papers should only be turned over to a respectable biographer, someone who would appreciate Samuel Goldwyn as an important cultural figure. So I think that's what drove him to me. Beyond that, he also knew I grew up in Los Angeles with a family in show business, so he knew I wasn't in awe of show business, but that I loved it. And I think those were the reasons.
Your father's a TV producer.
He is a producer, and then I have an older brother who is an agent as well.
So what was in the archives? I know millions and millions of things, but can you give us an overall sense of what you found in there?
Yeah, overall, these archives included every letter Samuel Goldwyn received, a carbon copy of every letter, memo, whatever he ever sent out, contracts, gin rummy IOUs. There were the menu books that Mrs. Goldwyn kept after each party of which guests were there. There were photographs by the tens of thousands. Literally every bit of minutia that ever crossed Sam Goldwyn's desk were contained in these two huge vaults.
So that gave you a lot to go through. Now, this is an authorized biography. What exactly does that mean?
Well, actually, yes, it's, quote, an authorized biography. It's an unusual situation in that it's authorized in that the family said, that is, Sam Goldwyn said, I would be the only person allowed to go through those papers, which really do give you 60 years of Hollywood history as well as Goldwyn's personal history. But it's not authorized in that he had no control over what went into the book. And in fact, before I started to write the book, I wanted him to sign a piece of paper, which he ultimately did, which said anything I found in those papers could be written in the book and that he would have no final cut over what I wrote.
Were there any arguments between you about how the book should be handled?
Well, ultimately, there were not. I mean, to be honest with you, it took a year from the time he first called me to ask if I was interested in writing the book and his signing of that document I just told you about.
Right.
He really did balk. But he finally realized that the only way he was going to get me or a serious biographer to take on his father was in signing such an agreement. Mm-hmm. And he did. And once he did, he was a most candid interviewee. I did 60 hours of interviews with him alone. And I always found him very, very honest and forthcoming.
Scott Berg is my guest, and we're discussing his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn. Early in your book, you say that Goldwyn, at an early age, invented himself. Can you compare who he was with who he turned himself into?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're all dealt a hand at birth, and I think Samuel Goldwyn was dealt as low a hand as you could get. He was born in Warsaw, named Shmuel Gelbfish. His father ran a junk store and died very young, leaving Shmuel with his five siblings and a mother whom he really didn't care for that much. The pogroms were at their height in Poland, and I think he realized the only way to survive was to get out of Warsaw. And so at 15, he decided to leave, and he walked across Europe. And I mean that literally. He went to Hamburg, where he got on a boat, went to England, where he had some relatives, and he walked across England to Birmingham to be with them. And then after a few years there, he got on a boat, traveled steerage class, was an illegal alien, sneaked across the Canadian border into America, went to New York, and almost immediately upon arrival, heard about a little town upstate called Gloversville, where indeed they needed people to make gloves. And that's what Samuel Goldwyn did in the beginning, and really stayed in Gloversville for many years, first as a glove maker, and then he became a glove salesman. Now that's who he started out as. All his life, he began this process of invention, and he kept inventing his way up. And ultimately, he changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn, not just because it was a more euphonious name, as indeed it was, but he went into business. This is when he was named Samuel Goldfish, with the Selwyn brothers. So they took the most lucrative-sounding syllables of each name, Gold and Wyn, put it together, leaving Selfish Productions behind, and then really began the serious process of invention, which really had to do with turning himself into a gentleman. He was never educated. He was really semi-literate at best, but he always had artistic aspirations, and I think that's what pulled him through in many ways and really contributed to this invention.
And you think it's appropriate, I'm sure, that someone who invented himself should also be funding the invention of American fantasies in film.
No doubt about it. And frankly, Terry, that was one of the things that drew me to the book, because I saw that he was such a perfect metaphor for the American dream, if you will. Not only did he believe in it, he grew up hearing about it, but then he came to America and lived it, and he made his living by manufacturing it.
I think most everyone thinks of Samuel Goldwyn as the G in MGM, and indeed he briefly was, but only briefly.
Yes, that's true. I mean, MGM is in fact the great misnomer in Hollywood history. Goldwyn did start the Goldwyn Company with the Selwyn brothers, but he was, after a few years, kicked out of the company, as he was kicked out of most companies he was involved in, simply because he couldn't have partners. People couldn't stand being around him, basically. And then the Goldwyn Company merged with Metro and Louis B. Mayer and became MGM. So indeed, he was not part of the company when the merger took place. It's interesting because he's really one of the few men ever named after a company. After the Goldwyn Company got off the ground, he legally petitioned to change his name to Goldwyn. But MGM, in fact, bought the Goldwyn Company name, not the man.
Well, so MGM, however, kept the logo that he had created, the lion.
Absolutely.
What's the story behind how the lion was created for the logo of the movies?
Well, actually, he hired a PR man named Howard Dietz, who later went on to become an amazing phenomenon in show business history, running the press office for MGM in its heyday, and also being a Broadway composer by night, writing some very important tunes.
With Arthur Schwartz.
Yes, exactly right. And Howard Dietz, while working for Goldwyn, was a Columbia University graduate and was asked to come up with a logo. So he really borrowed the Columbia Lion. Now, at the same time, the Goldwyn offices were literally across the street from the New York Public Library, which had these gleaming pink lions out in front, chiseled in marble. And the positioning of the lion was actually borrowed from the library. And so it remained. And it was Arthur Dietz, again, who threw in the Ars Gratia Artis. He thought, gee, movies... Goldwyn wanted everything to be classy. He wanted his pictures to be elegant. So Dietz thought, I better throw in a little Latin to make it sound fancy.
So Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer bared Samuel Goldwyn's name, although he wasn't part of the company. How did he tag his own movies?
It said Samuel Goldwyn Presents, and then it said a Samuel Goldwyn Production. And everyone thought this was sheer egotism on his part, getting his name up there twice. But in fact, when he started to make his own movies, MGM sued him, saying, "You cannot use the Goldwyn name. We bought that." And he went to court over it. And finally, Judge Learned Hand said, "A self-made man is entitled to a self-made name. Mr. Goldwyn may use his name, so long as he makes it clear he is not part of MGM. And then after a few years, the courts and MGM said he could simply say Samuel Goldwyn Presents, whatever the movie was.
So you've explained his role in MGM, or lack of it.
Yes.
What about with United Artists, with whom he was affiliated?
Well, now, you see, Sam Goldwyn was an independent producer. And as a producer of films, he then needed somebody to distribute them. And beginning in 1919, this new idea hit motion pictures, which was the artists themselves actually distributing their own movies. And it began when Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, and D.W. Griffith formed their own distribution company. And they realized they were the biggest money makers in movies. Why should they not produce their pictures and then distribute them themselves? Now, when talkies came in, their careers were all on the way out, and they needed somebody else to keep the company going. So they were constantly looking for new independent producers who might keep them supplied with product. And that's where Sam Goldwyn came in. They brought him in ultimately as a partner to distribute his films. And really, throughout the late 20s and early 30s, it was the Samuel Goldwyn films that kept that company alive. And then, as invariably happened with every company that Samuel Goldwyn belonged to, he wanted to take it over, and the partners wanted to get rid of him, which they ultimately did.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his very first movie, and this is back in 1913 that it was made. It was called Squaw Man. It was directed by Jesse Lasky, who was Goldwyn's brother-in-law at the time.
And it was really produced by Lasky with him.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks. And mm-hmm. It was written or directed by Cecil B. DeMille?
It was directed by DeMille.
Okay. Now, this film was supposed to be shot in Arizona, but it ended up being one of the first big productions in L.A., in Hollywood.
That's right. It was Samuel Goldwyn, actually, who talked his brother-in-law, Jesse Lasky, who was a vaudevillian, into going into the movie business with him, and they bought a property called The Squaw Man, which had been a fairly successful Broadway play, and then they went to hire a director. They went actually looking for a successful writer named William DeMille, and they went to DeMille's mother to ask if William DeMille might work on the script, and she said, no, he's tied up, but you might be interested in my other son, Cecil, who at that point was really the family ne'er-do-well, didn't quite know what career he was going to pursue for the rest of his life. And anyway, he did become the director of that film, got on the train to film it in Flagstaff, Arizona. When he got off the train, Arizona didn't look like the West to him. It wasn't what he had imagined all this time. So he got back on the train and went to the end of the line, which happened to be Los Angeles. And he was there but a few days when he rented a barn in which to make the film, in, as he called it, in a telegram home, a place called Hollywood. And he wrote a telegram back to Goldwyn back in New York asking if he could rent a barn to make that first movie.
Well, Goldwyn was initially pretty upset at this idea, wasn't he? Because it was even farther away than he thought.
Absolutely. And you see, with Goldwyn, Goldwyn believed in absolute control. So whenever anything got out of his hands, to say nothing of out of his sight, he really started to panic.
So how did they end up moving their production to Hollywood?
Well, ultimately, there were several good reasons to move to Hollywood. And in fact, movies did make a pit stop in Fort Lee, New Jersey for a while. After New York, Fort Lee became the movie capital of the world. And then by the late teens, Hollywood began to catch on. The city of Los Angeles was building up. Of course, weather was very good out there. And the city of L.A. offered a lot of different scenery, a lot of different topography that they could play with. There, within a two-hour drive, you could have the ocean, the desert, the mountains. So it was really quite suitable for filming.
Well, how important was Goldwyn's decision to move his operation to Hollywood in the establishment of Hollywood as the capital of the film industry?
Well, I think it was rather important. It was really he who was the one who took over what later became the MGM Studios. He bought that big studio in Culver City, and when the Goldwyn Company merged into MGM, they took the studio as well. But just his presence on the scene had a great effect. You see, the studio system was building up, and if you did not belong to that studio system, you were basically a fly-by-night independent producer. Goldwyn was the first independent producer really to bring some artistic integrity to the films he made. He was not there just to make a fast buck. He was really there for the duration, and I think his presence alone had a great impact on the rest of the film community.
Well, I was just reading in the New York Times that Samuel Goldwyn Jr., the person who approached you to write this book, is re-releasing Wuthering Heights in honor of its 50th anniversary. This was one of Samuel Goldwyn's favorite of his own productions. So let's talk about this movie a little bit. First of all, do you know more about why it's getting re-released?
Well, I think mostly because of the 50th anniversary, and it does happen to coincide with my book coming out. I think that possibly has something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It also occurred to Sam Goldwyn Jr. that this is one of those 50-year-old movies that still works. I mean, it's just an amazing movie, the power it has. It's really as effective today as it was in 1939, I think.
Yet Samuel Goldwyn didn't want to do the movie when the script was first offered to him.
No, it's true. In fact, almost everyone in Hollywood was reluctant to make it. It was a depressing, dark love story. It really wasn't like the Hollywood love stories that were being cranked out. And the main reason he was interested in it, besides hearing the story and getting moved by it, he certainly never read the book, he had Merle Oberon under contract, and he realized that she could be a very good Kathy. So that was primarily what prompted him to take it.
Mm-hmm. So, you say that one of the things that confused him about the movie is that there's flashbacks, and this left him baffled. I mean, how much did he meddle with the making of the movie?
Well, meddled. I would say this. Sam Goldwyn really had everything to do with every aspect of making all his movies. At the same time, I think one of his talents was he knew how to harness talent, and he always was attracted to the best talent. In this particular case, he bought the script that had been written on speculation by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, you know, two of the most important playwrights in America of the day, and they really wrote a wonderful screenplay. So he began with some very good material. Then he got director William Wyler, then he began hiring the cast, but he always let each of the departments do its own work. I mean, when Wyler was actually filming, Goldwyn usually stayed off the set, but the minute the film began to come in as something other than how he envisioned it, then he would step in and start to make waves.
Merle Oberon died shortly before you were able to talk with her.
Literally days.
Yeah. Were you able to interview Laurence Olivier?
I was, actually. I didn't get much time with him, in fact. And he had written a bit about Wuthering Heights anyway, and he had spoken to some other interviewers, and so I was able to get that. He was one, at the time I went to interview him, he was reluctant to talk because he was writing his own book.
Is this the kind of thing you run into a lot, that actors want to save their memories for their own memoirs?
To be honest with you, he was the only one.
Uh-huh.
And then, as it turns out, when I finally read his book, he hardly mentioned Wuthering Heights at all. So I went back and fired a few important questions I had to him.
And what did he tell you?
Well, what we got into was really the trauma on that set. It was just constant bickering among everybody. There was nobody happy during the entire making of that picture. Olivier thought Merle Oberon was really just a little tramp who had gotten lucky in the movies. Merle Oberon thought Laurence Olivier was this rather pompous stage actor who was a bit hammy and kept spitting in her face every time they would do scenes close to each other. William Wyler, who was known in Hollywood for years as 40 Take Wyler, for just reason, literally used to do 40 and 50 takes at a time, so he was never content with the way it was going. The actors were being driven crazy having to do scenes over again. Merle got sick and had to be taken to the hospital, but still hadn't done the hurricane sequence the way Wyler wanted it. So Sam Goldwyn came up with the idea that they would heat the rainwater that was being sent through propellers during the hurricane scenes. And so the only way she would do her scenes was with warm water, basically. So it just went on and on like this. It was just a nightmare.
And you wouldn't know it to see the movie.
Well, that's it. You see it, and it's just this absolutely evocative, wonderful, romantic film that totally works.
Well, if making Wuthering Heights and working with William Wyler were among Samuel Goldwyn's best decisions, I think it's fair to say one of his worst decisions was to try to turn the actress Anna Sten into the new Greta Garbo.
Oh, boy. Yes, this was probably the low point of Sam Goldwyn's career. Yes, Garbo had become the greatest star in the world, needless to say, and every producer was trying to come up with his Garbo, and he discovered an actress from the Ukraine named Anna Sten and poured millions of dollars into three huge vehicles for her, Nana, and then a movie called We Live Again, and then a third movie called The Wedding Night with Gary Cooper. And once Goldwyn saw all three movies had failed at the box office and that she couldn't even bring in a crowd when Gary Cooper was in the picture, he just dropped her, never saw her again, and that was that.
What were some of his techniques for trying to transform her into a new Garbo?
Well, first of all, he tried to cultivate this air of mystery about her, and he kept her from talking to the press, and he stashed her away. Of course, he was smart enough to know that she really didn't speak English very well either, so it was just as well that she didn't talk to anybody. And then he had these films written for her. He really had vehicles made. And of course, this was the day when producers did that. They really made movies to showcase stars. This was really part of the studio system then. And Goldwyn, who wasn't part of the system, really had to scrounge. He really had to look for crumbs and try to make it into a loaf.
My guest is Scott Berg, and we're talking about his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn. Goldwyn was one of the few, perhaps the only, I don't know, mogul in Hollywood who opposed the imprisonment of the Hollywood Ten, and when he was subpoenaed by UAC, he said that the most un-American activity which I have observed in connection with the hearings is the committee itself. Was he just being different from everybody else, or did he genuinely did he genuinely oppose what UAC was doing?
Yes. I would say both to those...
But he was both ornery and he genuinely
Yes, he was
it.
Both. And I'll tell you, it was interesting, and this will reveal something about my source, too. When I interviewed Lillian Hellman, which I did rather extensively for
And she had
book,
written for him.
Exactly. She was his big screenwriter in the late 30s and early 40s. And indeed, they did several successful pictures together, including The Little Foxes, which Goldwyn called The Three Little Foxes. But she, during the interview... said that Sam Goldwyn, the only reason he stood up against all the other producers and HUAC was because he was being different. But when I was going through the files, through the archives back in the 40s, I found telegrams from Lillian Hellman thanking Sam Goldwyn for taking such a strong stand. And the fact is, he really did lay his name and his company on the line. And it was a rather bold position. And I think ultimately the reason the committee never called Goldwyn, although they did subpoena him, is I think they were so afraid that he would draw so much sympathy to his side that they didn't. And no, I think he took a very gutsy stand there, to be honest with you.
Did your opinion of movie moguls change during the course of writing this book?
Well, it did to some extent in that I realized how great these men were. I mean, they all came from such humble origins, and they really created entire empires. And just the sheer energy and aspirations alone really made me think a lot differently about them. Beyond that, though, I think it goes back to the American dream again, which certainly Samuel Goldwyn believed in. And these stories to them, they were not just out to make money. I mean, Samuel Goldwyn would have liked nothing more than to have been a very rich man. But every time he got up to bat to make a movie, to make a Wuthering Heights that nobody else wanted to make, he really was trying to leave a mark somewhere. He really was interested in the perpetuation of his name. And I think he saw he could do that through his movies somehow. And he wanted that name, Goldwyn, to stand for quality, to stand for something different. And, you know, all the other moguls were like that to an extent. They believed in those movies.
One last question about Samuel Goldwyn. His movie career starts at the very beginning of movies, in 1913.
That's right.
What about where his career ends? Now, he died in 1974.
That's right.
Does his movie career end at a pivotal point in movie history?
Well, I think it does, really, and in a way doesn't quite end, in that most of Hollywood's product today is made by independent producers, men and women now, who really function as Samuel Goldwyn had all those years. There is no studio system as there was, and therefore producers are really following the example he set. The only major difference being, and this is what made Goldwyn unique, is that every time he made a movie, he had no partners, no parent company, no stockholders. Sam Goldwyn went to the bank, took out a loan, and put up something as collateral. So I think that's a good lesson for today's independent producers, too. A lesson about commitment, really.
Is your next book going to be a biography?
I think it will be. One has to approach these things very carefully, since it means you're going to seal the next decade of your life in that envelope. But I think I would like to write another biography of a 20th century American cultural figure. Not in the movies and probably not in literature.
Well, Scott, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work and about Goldwyn's work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.